Hello and welcome to the EDH Retcast, where we're all about commander data and dad jokes. I'm Joey Schultz and I'm joined by my fantastic co-hosts. Up first, he can't wait to meet the dog named Dog Meat. It's Matt Morgan.
This weekend I bought probably the world's worst thesaurus. Not only is it terrible, it's also terrible.
Oh, Matt.
Did I mention that it's probably, I think it's probably like pretty terrible.
Oh, wow. Oh, yeah. That's terrible, man. I'm really sorry for you.
It's a terrible experience.
That's terrific. All right. Up next, if he builds a Mr. House deck, it will indeed be a house. It's Dana Roach.
In honor of the Magic Con this weekend, I got a little bit of Chicago humor for you. How do you keep a bear out of your backyard in Chicago?
How, Dana?
Paint it like an end zone.
I don't understand. This is
nothing scares a bear in Chicago more than the possibility of being in an end zone.
I thought you were going to say you hang a pennant, but those are Cubs, not bears. Smaller that bears. Joey, it's sports ball.
Yeah, no, these jokes are aerodynamically designed to go right over my head. Anyway. Anyway, Dana, what are we talking about in this week's episode, man?
We're going to talk about the most overrated cards of the last two-ish years.
I think we actually limited to just about the last year. Some overrated cards, which is a big word to throw around. So I'm sure this won't be the kind of thing that feels incendiary to people at all, but it should be interesting to get into. Are these cards not quite measuring up to what people expected them to do or what we expected them to do? It'll be interesting.
We'll see how often Matt calls them terrible.
I think listeners might have a pretty terrible time listening to that if that was the case.
Absolutely. But we've got some shout outs to do before we get into our main topic. First up, we got to thank Chase, aka Mana Curves, for their terrific work on the post production of the show. Thank you so much, Mana Curves.
And we are now members of Team Ultimate Guard as well. So if you see us this weekend, right now possibly, at MagicCon Chicago, be playing with some sweet Boulder deck boxes and have all of our decks hooked up with katana sleeves. So come say hi.
And if you'd like to support the show, you can do so by subscribing on YouTube. We're coming up on 100,000 subscribers, and we would love to hit that goal by the end of the year. So make sure that you, your friends, your family subscribe, because we would love to hit that, and we appreciate all the support there. And it's a free way to support us. But also, you can go to patreon.com/edhretcast. We have patron tiers of all sorts of levels, whether you want to join the Discord community for just $2 a month, you want to see all of our historic challenges, stats, picks, there's all of that and more over at patreon.com/edhretcast, including the weekly, the coveted patron shout out, which we're going to give this week to Jared Too, who was not too good to go to patreon.com/edhretcast. I think you should go to Patreon to support us.
Y'all absolutely slay me. And Matt always is going to find the joke that I was not expecting, which, Matt, I appreciate about you very, very much. So
I do what I can. Just keeping you on your toes, Joey.
Indeed, indeed. Keeping me on my twos. No, that was terrible. Okay, let's just quit while we're ahead. Let's get into our main topic. We were talking about some overrated cards from the past year. Because I think if we were to expand it to all of Magic history, we'd be talking about, like, hey, there are a lot of people who misuse Brainstorm and stuff like that. So we do actually kind of want to keep a small window here. And I hope it's okay with you guys if I start us off with the card Everybody Lives, which I think I'm not alone in having put this card forward as an overrated card from the past year. I think that one of you guys also felt the same way.
It was definitely one of the ones that I was debating putting on the list for sure.
See, like, I'm just now looking at this card because I missed pretty much everything about the Doctor Who sets. There's a few cards that I have seen, but also looking at this, it's okay. You can't lose the game, Angel's Grace type of effect on there, but I also see the price tag and I don't think it's that good.
That's really it. Is a lot of the cards that I tried to err on the side of are like, are these worth their price tag? And that's kind of where overrated comes into the discussion for me. Everybody Lives is the 2-mana instant. All creatures gain hexproof and indestructible until end of turn. Players gain hexproof until end of turn. Players can't lose life this turn, and players can't lose the game or win the game this turn. It's currently showing up in 12,000 decks. That's 3% of decks that are eligible to play it. It's a, you know, fairly new card. The top commanders for it are certainly going to be, like, a lot of the Doctor Who commanders, and even some group hug things as well, which is cool, but I think a lot of people expected this card to be Teferi's Protection, and and it's really not. it's really, really not. Like, even when you cast this card to protect from, like, a board wipe, for instance, you are saving other people's stuff in a way that Heroic Intervention and Teferi's Protection make things one-sided. And so a lot of the use cases for this card have felt very disappointing in comparison to what we know spells like this can usually do. So that's why I'm putting it forward as a little overrated. And to me, I wouldn't pay 15 or 17 or however many dollars it is to go and get this one.
Yeah, part of the power that comes with Teferi's Protection is that it allows your stuff to dodge whatever else is going on, but still there's three other players that are going to be affected by it. And so protecting your board versus protecting everyone's board and kind of freezing the game in time for a moment, that's where I think a lot of the power really comes from with Teferi's Protection type of cards, because it's only saving your stuff to then come back on there. Even cards like Cyclonic Rift, it's getting rid of everybody else's stuff, but your stuff is still untouched.
Yeah, it's not a bad card at all. I like it, and I actually think it's kind of a clever design.
Yeah.
But the reason it's overrated is it's not Teferi's Protection. It's not that kind of card that's useful in a dozen different situations in every deck that's able to run white. And from a design perspective, maybe that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think we need cards that are silver bullets and that are automatically an auto included every single deck. So I maybe like this design more than Teferi's Protection.
Yeah.
But the reality is, if you are looking at this like a second copy of Teferi's Protection, it's not that. It's a much narrower card that does much narrower things, and it's important to remember that when you include it. And it, based on its inclusion numbers and decks so far, I don't think people are aware of how much more limited it is than Teferi's Protection.
Yeah, like it scuppers a Thassa's Oracle, and that's very, very funny. But that's a very narrow use case. To me, the thing that I found most effective with it is it giving your stuff hexproof when someone's trying to single target removal. But like, I don't know, two mana for that effect. I'm like, I don't know.
It's also a very, very crowded field too. The one mana save one of your things. Like, you have Tyvar's Stand, which I don't think Tyvar's Stand is nearly as great, just because, like I said, it's a crowded field. I almost thought about putting Tyvar's Stand on my list for this, because there's so many different variations of that single effect that I don't think any one really stands out anymore.
Yeah, and even just in white, there's Lauren's Escape, and like, that's a quarter to acquire.
Yeah.
And the fog aspect of this card is kind of interesting too, because like, oh, you can't lose life. But Dana, you've got a point about the commander damage-y issue that sometimes comes with Everybody Lives.
Yeah, or Infect as well.
Yeah.
Like, it buys you a split second. It buys you like long enough to say pass a turn. Right. and then it stops. That effect quits working.
Yeah, because it doesn't stop the damage. So commander damage still happens to you even if your life total doesn't change, which is different than Teferi's Protection, because you gain protection from stuff. So like, you won't be dealt the damage. But like, yeah, it's just a very funny, like, huh, there are all these little use cases that make this card not as great as we all hoped it would be, maybe.
In the last note I will make about it is, I'm someone who runs Blacksmith Skill in a couple decks. That's a single white mana instant that gives a creature indestructible and hexproof. Mm. And it buffs an artifact creature, but that's really relevant. One of the things I've been looking at since this card was released is like, oh, I wonder, do I want to upgrade Everybody Lives? So whenever I had a Blacksmith Skill in hand and wound up using it, I thought to myself, okay, would I prefer Everybody Lives here? And I've never said yes. Mm-hmm. Like, I've never had an answer where like, I would have rather have had this card in my hand and had to leave two mana up and had a situation where it was relevant that Blacksmith Skill just didn't do the job for one less.
Or even there's another new card that we just got last year too, with Surge of Salvation, which that's kind of overperformed for me a lot too, which one mana, you and permanents you control gain hexproof until in turn. So if like, that's all you're trying to do, it's going to save all of your permanents from single target removal for that entire turn. So I don't know if it's worth protecting your opponent's boards for one extra. And there's more obviously than just like the hexproof aspect. I get that.
Right.
Right.
But also I don't want to protect my opponent's stuff.
Yeah.
Either. That's my big drawback.
Yeah. Yeah. Now that we've seen so many cards that can protect you, just you, having something that goes everywhere, you do have to find a lot more specific cases for it than maybe it first appeared. And so that's why that, combined with the higher price tag, makes me be like, I think I'm going to put this as an overrated one. But that was one of mine. Matt, how about one of yours?
So one of mine, it's a card that I feel, it's probably just bad for the power levels that I play at, especially when with you guys, you're going to my local game store, and it's CEDH where this card really shines. But I just, We all know that I don't think Monologue Tax is a great card. So why is everybody hyped about Monologue Tax on a two-color creature? And Lotho Corrupt Sheriff is kind of that.
Really?
To me. So whenever a player casts their second spell each turn, you lose one life and create a treasure token, and it's on a 2-1 body. I don't think Lotho was all that great. Like, why would I want to lose a life and create a treasure when you can just put on Monologue Tax? You're not losing any life. To see Lotho in as many decks as it's in, I mean, it's in 45,000, excuse me, decks. And that's 11% of eligible decks. I don't think that Lotho is near that powerful that it should be showing up in this many numbers.
Interesting. Now, there is an important distinction between Monologue Tax and Lotho, which is that Monologue Tax only counts your opponents, whereas Lotho says any player casting their second spell. So if you cast Lotho and then something else, like, you do get an immediate benefit from it. So to me, there is that difference, which helps a lot. But in your experience, has this card not produced a lot of treasures for you?
It's not produced a lot of treasures for me. And maybe it's just because, like I said, the power level that you play it at, if you're playing at the CEDH levels where literally everyone is playing two spells per turn every turn, then yeah, there might be a huge payoff there. But I don't think losing a life to get a treasure is all that valuable to me, honestly. I could be completely far off, but I just don't think Lotho, especially for the price tag on the card, that's where I'm just kind of very concerned, because for a while there, it was a pretty pricey card. It's dropped down a little bit, but man, I've never been terribly impressed with this, even when I've seen on the battlefield.
Dana, what do you think about losing life to get things?
Well, that's biased.
I'm all for it. I'm all for it. However, I'm with Matt here in that I think this the way the game works today, even at a casual level, a piece that exists in your list just to provide incremental value probably isn't enough to justify a slot these days. And that's what this is. And it's not even for the most part like it's part like it's a creature type that's relevant necessarily, and you're like, well, I'm running this, you know, Thassa's Oracle. If you're not playing the combo, isn't that amazing of a card? But maybe if you're playing a Merfolk Kindred deck, well, it's maybe good enough just to get the ETB trigger or something, even if you're not, like, doing the abusive thing with it. Halfling Rogue isn't even necessarily a relevant creature types in very many decks. So it's a value piece that probably generates some decent value, I guess. But that isn't interesting, I don't think, or even particularly useful in a deck these days when it feels like every card's a haymaker.
For me, this one, I actually find the fact that it's legendary to be one of the things that kind of, like, sets it up, not in terms of it being a commander, but, like, that kind of buys it places in, like, Rotodropic and Dehata decks, for example.
Sure.
But that is, I mean, that's going to be the case in tons of the cards that we'll talk about today, where, like, yeah, in this very specific deck, they're going to do a whole lot of stuff. I still like Lotho. I only have it in one deck where the rogue part is relevant. I've got a party deck. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's interesting. To me, the part that's hardest about this card is remembering the dang trigger, because I'm very bad at that. So if I'm going to call anything overrated, it's just my own ability to remember that this thing triggers on people's second spells.
It's the skill issue, yeah.
A skill issue. Thank you, Matt. Thank you. Wow. Okay.
Yeah, it's a thing that it's one of those cards that, like, I've seen it pop up in decks where I don't understand why it's in that deck other than the person thought it was a good card and put it in, which is fine. But, like, it's been the kind of card that hits a field enough, and I've, having watched how the deck played out, thought, why is that in your list?
Interesting. Okay. Maybe I don't have enough experience with this one, so I'll have to investigate a little bit more. So that's an interesting pick that I would not have expected.
Yeah, I mean, the card is in the top 25 cards from last year, and that just,
wow.
Seeing it over some other cards that you could have been, that from last year, as far as how popular they are, I struggle to think Lotho is better in just a majority of decks.
Yeah. And that's an interesting, you know, that's a good angle as well. It's not like, oh, this card is overrated in specific. Like, that's not what you're saying. It's just like, yeah, we got a lot of cards last year. So for it to be among the top 25, that is actually a surprise to me. I'll definitely. So from that perspective, I see where you're coming from for sure. Dana, I think that moves us on to you.
My first here is Staff of Completion. 3-mana artifact, has 4 different abilities on it. Pay 1 life to destroy target permanent you own. You can tap it and pay 2 life to add a mana of any color. You can tap it and pay 3 life to proliferate. And you can tap it and pay 4 life to draw a card. And then you can also spend 5 mana to untap it and do any of those things again. So I guess technically 5 abilities. The problem with Staff of Completion is none of them are that particularly powerful. It's a fine card, but I think like the fact that Staff of Domination was a feared card and an outright banned card for so long, that like getting a updated version of that has maybe skewed some people's understanding of how powerful it is. I have two decks that would care about proliferate and run proliferate effects, and this isn't good enough for either of them.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's not a decent card, but like I look at it and like, oh, there's better ways to do anything this deck does, and while it, or this card does, and all the other things it does aren't necessarily even that useful to offset it.
I've been terribly, and I wouldn't say underwhelmed, but I've just been whelmed. Like this card, people, the hype surrounding this card definitely fell short of what it ended up doing in the format.
Yeah, exactly. Because you see it, and the immediate callback is to that Staff of Domination.
Yeah.
As a quick, like, just let me check this. I went to the Commander Spellbook website, which can track combos, and also it has some Idiotrek integration there to see how popular those combos actually are. Staff of Domination has 167 possible combos in the Commander Spellbook database, which is really interesting to see. And a lot of them are very popular. Staff of Completion has 11 possible combos. And the most popular of those combos currently shows up in 148 decks total.
Yeah.
So I just think that's probably noteworthy in terms of us comparing these cards yeah. and how one didn't quite measure up to what people thought based off of Staff of Domination. So Dana, this is a really good pick. I totally forgot about this card until you said it. Like, just fully.
Staff of Completion is the sequel that's doing a lot of drafting on how good the original movie was.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but this happens a lot, though, where I feel like we see a card that is a callback to a previously very, very powerful card, and then the callback just doesn't really live up to the expectations or the the expectations, yeah, is probably the big one of what is this card trying to do? Is it pretending to do? Does it want to do? And Staff Completion is probably the poster child for these things just falling flat when it comes to living up to the reputation of its predecessor.
Yeah, that's a really good way to put it. It is like the expectations that we as players are bringing into it affects things a whole lot for sure. And actually, I just want to pause and remark upon the fact that Dana was calling a card that allows you to pay life for benefit overrated. Paying life right. for stuff is like Dana's favorite thing. What's going on, man?
Twice in a row we've done that. I've done that.
I know. All right. I'm going to move on to my next one. And listen, I was trying not to put just white cards into my list, but this one is also a white card. I'm sorry about that. But Ohirotok, Deepest Foundation is the 6-mana token tripler. And it's like $21 right now. And this one, I also had to be like, I saw this card and I was like, I'm not going to get that for my tokens deck. It's the 6-mana 6/6 vigilance. If you would create tokens, you create 3 times that many instead. And if it dies, it can flip over into a land and the land does nice, really cool stuff. But this is one that I'm just like, I can't. I'm sorry, I can't. Taking off this, like this turn six, that's a lot. And the difference between this and like stuff like Mondrak and Anointed Procession, which are also very expensive, and those ones just double your tokens. To me, the numbers, it just kind of becomes an academic thing. I'm just like, listen, if I turn my 4 tokens into 8 tokens with an Anointed Procession, it doesn't feel all that different if I were to turn them into 12 tokens with Ohirotok. So I have not gone out of my way for this one just because it did. I don't know. It's currently showing up in like 20,000 decks, 5% of the decks that are eligible to play it, but this has not really struck my heart in the way that it seems to have struck other people's. So what do you guys think?
So I've just got a copy of Ohirotok in the mail, so I haven't gotten a chance to play with it yet. I am curious about it. That is for sure, because it's a very powerful effect. It's tripling anything in this game is a very, very powerful and desirable type of effect. And so I am curious to all the reasons that you argued against it, I agree with. And I think that's probably one of the big things to keep it in check. But also just sometimes, I mean, Nyx Bloom Ancient, everybody was kind of like, well, at that point, is it really worth tripling? Turns out, yes. So at that point, tripling the tokens you make, that it probably still is yes.
I think it certainly can be. And I also truly think that this is going to be at its best when you're like tripling individual important tokens.
Sure.
Like the Radodrabic that I mentioned earlier, where you're just making a single copy of things and then turning that into three copies. I think that's where you'll find the most effectiveness with this type of effect. But when it just comes to this is a deck that just wants to have a whole bunch of bodies on the battlefield, there are already so many ways of accomplishing more bodies than your opponents know what to do with that for me, it hasn't felt like, oh, a triple will make a meaningful difference in that regard. I don't know. Dana, do you agree, disagree? Have you got experience with this one?
So the first thing I want to note here is way back in the day when we were doing a set review and we were talking about the card Fiery Emancipation, which was, I believe, the first damage tripler.
I know where this is going.
Oh, no. Okay, I see where you're going.
It was a card I liked, but I made the same note that I'm not sure it's functionally any different than Gratuitous Violence, which just doubled the damage. I'm not saying I didn't like the card. I just was saying it's fine. It's a thing we already have. So like getting excited about tripling a thing didn't seem much different than excited about doubling a thing. So I'm kind of on board with what you're saying here, Joey. However, the one thing I do think there's a difference, like Matt said, between tripling your mana and doubling it. I don't know if there is for damage. I always feel like Gratuitous Violence kills somebody just as easily as Fiery Emancipation usually. So the question becomes, is that which end of the spectrum here is tokens on? I tended to think it's maybe more relevant in tokens, particularly because more often than not, they're 1/1s, and the more you can get, the easier it is to like take people out. But I'm not sure either because I haven't seen this card played enough. I do, however, tend to agree that like the level of excitement for seeing the words triple on it compared to the level of excitement that people would have had if it just said double, I don't know if it's worth the reaction. I don't know if it's that much better than like just doubling.
See, I don't know, because Mondrak Glory Dominus is the number 2 card from 2023. And all that does is double your tokens. So there's a huge difference. I know like doubling, it's still powerful, but like there's a huge, huge difference between I'll do a thing and make 3 tokens and I'll do a thing and make 9 tokens. That is a massive difference. And even then, mm-hmm. I would say exponentially better than just 3 to 6, just in the terms of the impact it makes on a game. So I really want to get this card into play and get a better idea, because I think either, Joey, you're going to be super right or you're going to be super wrong. And I don't know which it is quite yet.
Well, the other thing, too, is that there's a massive difference between like something like Mondrak that you play at turn 4 versus something like Ohertak that you play for 6 mana. Like 4 mana versus 6 mana is a very different creature to me. And Mondrak even having the ability to make itself indestructible has also been very relevant. And even just like being, it's got its own little sacrifice outlet effect that I've been very impressed by as well. But like, yeah, this is a card that like, if you're using it, I bet it can have huge payoffs for you. But there have been enough times where I'm like, I don't know if I need this in play, because there are even times when I'm playing in game where I'm just like, I don't have a turn to play a doubling season right now. And doubling season's a great card, but I could also like see cases where it's kind of overrated. To get back to the Fire Emancipation thing though, Dana, I am going to still push back on you on that one. Because to me, here's another difference with the creation of tokens versus what Fire Emancipation does. Like creating, like you play Ohertak and then it needs to stay alive and then you can create something and then you'll get your payoff. And then those tokens will be able to attack on a later turn, I guess. Fire Emancipation takes your board that is already full, you play it and then surprise, this is a lot more lethal than you thought it was. Those are two different stages of tempo that I think are relevant for the conversation when it comes to what we're tripling.
But Joey, I think also that same argument applies the other way to Ohertak too, though, because you could have, say, a token generating engine on board already, and then you drop Ohertak, and then that just pushes it overboard because you're able to do it without needing to invest mana necessarily. And so I think that argument applies both ways. Not that it's an incorrect argument. I just think that it goes towards both of these cards.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, I think in a lot of there are plenty of tokens decks that are going to do that. Like your Bernards and your Myrrol Shield of Argives are going to be like already set up to help you. And maybe that's a good distinction to point out is like, is the deck ready to have this be a surprise? Uthari could be potentially another one of those. Mm-hmm. And so you have to create those scenarios as opposed to. Okay. So that does make sense. And so a lot of the decks, the ways that I'm using tokens, do not have those already built-in engines. And it's much more like I have to keep my Anointed Procession style card alive until the next turn where I can get the payoff. So that's a good tempo distinction.
Which is curious because I think in your Thalisse deck, this would be an absolute just monster because it triples the tokens you make. And then at the end of the turn, it triples those tokens that you make, which is already tripled. That's where I think this is kind of the situation where Overtalk really gets out of hand.
Well, yes, but what I'm saying is that if I've already used Thalisse to make 10 bodies in play, I might be able to kill you next turn regardless, so I don't know if I need to have 30 or however many.
Would you be better served at that point running like a clever concealment or some way to save your stuff from a board wipe versus like turning a kill into overkill?
Yeah, that's where the numbers start to feel a little bit academic to me, and that's why this card is so interesting to talk about. And I think that there are cases where it might be a bit of a distraction to take that turn off. And again, it being an expensive card means that I just want to put a little caution about just like, you don't feel like you need to go get this one. But Matt, now that you do have this one, I'm curious to see how it works for you compared to how it would work for me.
Well, I mean, hopefully I get a chance to report back in on it because I've been trying to report in on Last March of the Ants for a year now and I still haven't gotten to. So hopefully it doesn't turn to that type of situation either.
We're in Chicago right now as this episode comes out. So Matt, I hope that you're playing some games with listeners and that you get the chance. You get the chance to cast it and resolve it.
All I want to do is resolve this card.
That's amazing. All right, we've got a lot of other examples that we want to get to, and not all of my picks for overrated cards are white cards, I promise. But we do also have to take a quick break for Challenge the Stats, one of our favorite segments here on the show, because there's so much data on EDHREC that we don't always agree with. So we'll take a quick break and come right back with that.
Do you follow automotive news? Or do you just like cars and want to see what the heck's going on? Well, then you might like Donut Media's new podcast, The Big Three. Hi, I'm James Pumphrey, and every week, me and my co-host slash two of my top five friends, Nolan Sykes and Joe Weber, unpack the latest and greatest in automotive news and trends on The Big Three. You'll also get a lot of laughs, hot takes, and personal insight on cars from the biggest car guys in automotive media. So, whether you're a hardcore enthusiast or just a person who goes, that's a good looking car, check out The Big Three, available wherever you get your podcasts, or you can watch the full videos at Donut Podcasts on YouTube.
My challenge this week is for a card called Spectacular Showdown. It's a sorcery for one and a red, and it says, put a double strike counter on target creature, then goad each creature that had a double strike counter put on it this way. However, it also has overload for four and three red, so you can put a double strike counter on every creature and then goad each creature that had a double strike counter put on it this way. I think that's genuinely just a really good card. How many people are going to survive? First of all, you swinging out double strike stuff if you cast it first main phase, and then everyone else smashing one another with double strike stuff, it's just going to wreck most people. However, there's always the concern that like somehow it makes it back around and everyone now has creatures with double strike counters on them, and they're going to set their sights on you. I, however, ran into this card the other night in a Primacon Sky Rampart deck. Is a three-color commander, blue, red, and white, for a legendary creature wall. It has flying and defender, and when it enters the battlefield, you choose left or right, and each player may only attack the nearest opponent in the chosen direction, and they can only attack planeswalkers that way as well. A commander that kind of eliminates any risk or downside to putting a bunch of double strike counters on your opponent's creatures. Mm. As just happened recently in a game I was playing against, the Primacon player picked the person who could attack him as someone who had one small body in play, so the double strike counter was irrelevant, and everyone else beat each other up because they had really no choice. Great card, and probably just should generally see more play, but if you're playing Primacon, it should be in more than 6% of lists for sure.
I love Spectacular Showdown. So it's spectacular indeed. Every time I've seen it cast, someone dies.
Yeah.
Like this card just straight up, someone's losing, and it's going to happen soon. So a really cool card, really cool pick. All right, I've got our listener-submitted Challenge the Stats this week, and this one comes to us from our Discord patron, Levi, who wants to talk about Isshin Two Heavens as one decks and the card Ryu Storm's Edge in those decks. Isshin is one of the most popular commanders in the format. This is the number three most popular commander right now with 20,000 decks to its name. That is wild. And Levi points out that Ryu Storm's Edge is showing up in 35% of those Isshin decks, and that might be a little overplayed. Isshin is the Mardu combat trigger doubler guy, which is really, really cool. But Ryu specifically says it's a 4-mana 3/3 human samurai with first strike. And it says whenever a samurai or warrior you control attacks alone, untap it. If it's the first combat phase of the turn, there's an additional combat phase after this phase. initially, this looked really cool. And Levi actually points out that they were using it in their Isshin decks for a good long while, but every time they saw Ryu in play, they were pretty disappointed by it. It didn't feel all that great, especially because the way that Ryu is worded, you're only going to untap once. Like, this is only triggering off of either Ryu or Isshin attacking alone, so you're not getting any of the combat triggers from any of your other creatures, and you actually don't get the benefits of the extra combat phase additional trigger because that untap effect only happens one time. And Levi also points out that, like, if you're attacking alone with Isshin, that's a really great way to get Isshin blocked or removed from the board. Levi says, this feels like an instance where people are seeing the when blank attacks and the words extra combat and assuming that therefore the card is like an auto-include with Isshin. But it doesn't actually feel all that possible to use this ability in a way that feels meaningful. So Levi, I've absolutely got to co-sign with you on this. 35% for Ryu Storm's Edge in Isshin decks. I also agree that that's too high. This is a card that I would totally cut from the deck too to make room for other cool combat damage triggers. Thank you so much for this challenge.
Well, I'll step up next then. And so my card is one that I kind of missed when everything was going through preview season. So Doctor Who, like I said earlier, I didn't really pay that much attention to. It wasn't really my kind of set. But as I'm digging through and finding new cards, one really stuck out to me. And then Joey kind of, you reinforced it as we were talking before the show. And the card Reverse the Polarity is a card that I'm kind of shocked with all the cool cards that we've seen in the past year or so. This one hasn't gotten more attention. So Reverse the Polarity is one blue-blue that says, choose one, counter all other spells, switch each creature's power and toughness until end of turn, and then the final mode is creatures can't be blocked this turn. So there's a lot going on there, and I know that Dana instantly is rolling his eyes because I said a three-mana counterspell, but there's more to it than just that. There's a lot going on with Reverse the Polarity. If you're playing a go-wide type of token deck and you would like to just get blockers through or get blockers out of the way, I should say, Reverse the Polarity is there for that. There's a lot of just corner case nice. It's almost like a charm, really, where there's so many just different little corner cases that this card is really going to shine. Maybe there's a counter war going on and people are getting all sorts of benefits from that. Well, it's just a good way to kind of fluster Storm and close the door on all the other spells that are going on there. I just really like this. It has a lot of overlap as far as a lot of applicability with C Double, which is another card from last year that I absolutely love. So just Reverse a Polarity, if you're playing stuff, I imagine that a lot of Bruticlad, Telcor Engineer decks would love this card. Mm. I know my Ovika Enigma Goliath, but anything that just you put a lot of creatures on the battlefield and you want them to punch through, that's great. But also, you can hold the three mana up and just counter all these spells that are going on there. And then I guess if you're playing against Tree Folk deck and there's a bunch of O7s laying around, well, there's a good way to board wipe them too, I guess. So there's a lot to like about Reverse the Polarity. There's a lot of flexibility. Just there's a lot going on there that's more than just the 4,500 decks that it's currently being played in would indicate otherwise. So if you need a nice, flexible option to fill one of those last slots in your deck, Reverse the Polarity is absolutely a great option to consider.
Yeah, it either protects your board or makes your board lethal. Those are two really great modes.
Yeah, it's such a powerful effect. I'm kind of shocked it hasn't latched on more.
All right, cool stuff. So now I think, guys, we are going to move back into our main topic here. I've named two cards that I thought were a little overrated or overhyped or whatever, but, you know, we got to get to the second one from one of you. Dana, let's pass it off to you. What's your next card that you think is maybe was overrated in the past year?
We'll see if this, maybe I'm just trolling Joey with this card. Breach the Multiverse.
Seems like you're trolling me a little bit. Yeah, really?
Five and double black sorcery. Each player mills 10 cards, and for each player, choose a creature or planeswalker card in that player's graveyard and put those cards onto the battlefield under your control. Then each creature you control becomes a Phyrexian in addition to its other types. That last line of text is largely irrelevant for the most part. So yeah. Mostly it's a way to reanimate three creatures and or planeswalkers. This is not a bad card again, but the way that it mills 10 people's cards into their graveyard, on one hand, in theory, gives you more options to choose from in terms of reanimation. On the other hand, sets you up to absolutely get domed by someone else who's playing a graveyard deck, in particular because you really, for the most part, can't do anything with those creatures until the following turn, unless they have a really juicy ETB. I just think there's better ways to do this same thing that aren't as risky. And if you're playing in a limited environment that doesn't have access to Rise of the Dark Realms or something, then I can see why you would go with this. But like, there are very few situations, I think, where I would choose this over Rise of the Dark Realms because of that uncontrollable mill portion. And I don't think I want both in a deck. That's why I think it's over it. I think we have a clearly superior choice, and I don't know why I would choose this, and I don't think I want both, but it's still showing up in 40,000 decks.
So as a real quick thing, the math, I think we need to point out, because people have already shattered it at their car stereos or written it in the comments. You said Revive 3. It will get 4, because it also counts you.
Oh, from yourself. That's true. Yes. Sorry.
So that's an important thing here. The milling, I understand where you're coming from, because this is like, yes, you are giving potential fuel to people, and we know that that's dangerous, especially if you're playing against me. But it's also like, if they didn't have a graveyard to begin with, well, now you've definitely got a hit off of them.
Sure.
And I've never been sad when I've cast this card ever. I cannot agree with you, but we also know I'm biased because I just I love everything graveyard, and I love reanimating, and the times that I've cast this spell, it has done some truly bug nutty things. I feel like the 4 enter the battlefield effects that you are likely to get off of this do have a pretty sizable impact right then and there. I also get, though, if you are comparing it to cards like Rise of the Dark Realms, I get where that comparison is coming from, too. And Rise of the Dark Realms does usually just, like, it's hard to lose a game after you resolve that spell. So I understand what you mean. I don't agree.
Like, I think I even would want Sulpurtial Primordial over this, I think.
I actually also understand that, because the fact that that's a creature, like, is a lot more abusable in the decks that care to abuse this type of effect. Like, you can blink it, you can sacrifice it, bring it back.
You'd run it in a deck that probably already has, you know, Animate Dead or Necromancer, or a bunch of other ways to reuse this after you've already used it multiple times. So, yeah, Breach is good. I just think that there's other things I would rather use more.
So I'll play the swing vote then here. I have had success casting Breach the Multiverse in Brawl. And it's fine there. I also think that Brawl is a vastly different format than Commander, just by the nature of there's being, you know, more players at the table. I kind of am going to side with Dana on this, though. I think you want to spend 2 more mana for Rise of the Dark Realms. There's other mass reanimation type of effects here. And Sepulchral Primordial is a fantastic alternative to this. Now, you don't get to mill the 10 cards. That's probably a big thing, but also, you're not fueling up Joey's graveyard when he's already got something on the battlefield. Like, he's got a Sir Conrad sitting there just, oh, please cast Breach the Multiverse because I'm going to kill you. And so there's a bunch of effects like that where it's probably situational, but I think I'm going to go with the safest and most reliable bet, and that most oftentimes is going to be something like Sepulchral Primordial, like some of the other alternatives.
I mean, maybe I just have magic PTSD from anything getting put in Joey's graveyard, and I don't want to contribute to it.
Yeah.
Honestly, that's very fair. Like, I think this is a card that you have to, you can't just windmill slam it in the way that you can some of the other animation effects out there.
Sure.
You do have to, like, take a moment, like, test the air, see if just, like, is the wind clear here for me to actually, like, play this safely? I understand. But, like, Matt, it's 7 mana to get 4 creatures into play. Like, even if that was, like, a green card, like, you'd have to be like, ooh, 4 creatures, right? Like, that's great. That's cool. There's, like, that's awesome.
With the mill effect, you're never going to whiff. There's always going to be targets. So that's definitely true.
Yeah, but also there's you can play Sylvala Stampede, and you're going to get the same amount, and you can just rip into all sorts of cool stuff there, too. So, like, I see where you're going with why Breach would be great. I just think that there's a lot of alternatives that are just kind of competing for what I would argue is a very crowded space in this type of effect.
All right. Well, Dana, I have to disagree with you, but I understand your caution. And being a cautious player has helped you out many a time. So I understand where you're coming from, but I am going to play this in so many decks regardless. Because also, like, calling a card overrated when it just makes me giggle this much. Like, if a card makes me laugh, I don't care. Like, there's also that aspect to it as well.
I can't argue with that.
Yeah. All right, Matt, how about you? What's your next one?
Well, I let's give Joey a break. I'm still going to challenge a black card, though, so, like, we're not really going to give Joey a break.
Oh, no.
So a card that I've seen that a bunch of people were very, very excited for, I put into a deck and I tried it out, and it was completely just not what I was expecting it to be, is Hoarding Broodlord, which is showing up in over 23,000 decks so far. And this card is fine, but paying 8 mana to, like, maybe you potentially convoke it out, and you get to basically tutor up a card and exile it and play it from exile. That's fine, but 8 mana for this kind of effect, I was not very impressed with this card when I played it myself. I've seen a couple people play it, and they seemed very excited by it, but also when I looked at it, I was like, that's all you're doing with that? Surely there's got to be better options. And so something about Hoarding Broodlord, it's one of the top 100 cards from 2023. And again, to do kind of what I did with my last challenge, this is seeing more play than cards like C Double or Up the Beanstalk. And those two cards are wild. Like, Up the Beanstalk literally is Wilds of Eldraine, but
wow.
You can't tell me that Hoarding Broodlord should be in more decks than Up the Beanstalk, which is just Up the Beanstalk, I think, is one of the best cards from last year.
Yeah. So Hoarding Broodlord, 8 mana, black dragon, 7/6, convoke and flying. And when it enters the battlefield, you search the library for a card, exile it face down, then shuffle, and you can play that thing as long as it's exiled. And spells that you cast from exile have convoke. And I have to assume that like that last line is what gets people intrigued, because there are so many strategies these days that let you play stuff from exile. But Matt, you're not picking on me at all. I actually agree with you. I don't like this card very much.
Yeah, and I assume that people want to play that in stuff like Prosper decks, but Prosper doesn't really need help, especially from a spell you're not casting until way late that costs 8 mana.
Prosper's got so many good cards that work in a Prosper deck that this one, I don't think it would necessarily make the cut. The fact that it's a dragon is interesting, but like, dragon decks are also really crowded, so
yeah, they are.
So that feels like a tough sell for this one too. I'm kind of with you. I don't think that I'd ever build a deck that has a home for this one, which is kind of a shame. It's an interesting idea, but I agree that like its inclusion rate like is higher than I would expect it to be.
It's in more decks than Moonshaker Cavalry, which that hurts my brain a lot.
So I have a Dimir Dragons deck. And there are so few good Dimir dragons that I'm running things like Icefall Regent and Phantasmal Dragon and Doom Breath Monstrosity. And there are so few good blue and black dragons that I just made one of those names up and you guys didn't catch it. Despite the fact that there's so few of them, Hoarding Broodlord doesn't make the cut for me in that list. So that should tell you how I feel about it. Now, to be fair, in a dragon deck, there's not a lot of bodies that I have that aren't being used to attack with that I can, you know, often use a Conspire ability. That's kind of a lost cause in that particular deck. But the kind of deck that can use it probably doesn't want a dragon. It wants like something that's synergizing with zombies, say, for example. And this, I don't know if it does. I think you'd be better off running something that does a bunch of zombie stuff than this. So it's an okay card, I think, that just doesn't necessarily fit on a dragon in the color black.
Yeah, well, and plus you mentioned playing it in a dragon's deck. If you're putting out these big, like, 5, 6, 7 mana spells and creatures, you probably don't want to be using them to convoke something.
Yeah.
You want to use those to turn them sideways and attack with them. And so you're asking the deck to do something it doesn't want to do anyways. And so maybe I'm completely off and you want to play this in a tokens deck as a payoff, but I don't think that's all that great of a payoff. I think you play Ur-Hertok instead.
Agreed.
And started to throw that one back out there, Joey, but
no, that's funny.
I don't think I'm wrong either.
Yeah, no, I get it. That's really funny. I like that. Man, I hate to just have like a stripe of black cards that we're all here discussing, but like I promise that my next card that I picked for this subject would not be another white card, and I actually picked a black card to try and show that I can be unbiased. I don't just love only the color black, and I worship all of the reanimator stuff, but I guess we're talking about another black card here, which I didn't intend to happen, but I wanted to put forth Drivnod Carnage Dominus as potentially an overhyped card. I've gone back and forth on this one a lot because it's not even all that expensive. It's currently like $5 or $6 right now. And the effect is good. We've seen with cards like Taysa, who's also one of the most popular commanders out there right now, that like doubling your death triggers, that's a good effect. Drivnod is a 5-mana, 8/3 Phyrexian Horror. If a creature dying causes a triggered ability of a permanent, you control the trigger. That ability triggers an additional time. You can also pay 2 Phyrexian black mana, exile 3 creature cards from your graveyard, and give it an indestructible counter. This one is showing up in 42,000 decks, 3% of decks that are eligible to play it, which is a high inclusion rate, all things considered. And it's doing that Taysa Karlov effect, doubling your death triggers. This one has felt very odd to me, though. I've tried to play it in a lot of stuff. Like, I put this into my Conrad deck stat because I was like, oh man, doubling Conrad's death triggers, that's going to be awesome. But it has not performed for me. It has a little bit of that feeling of like the setup piece, the tempo is off. I have to take a turn off to get this one here. Trying to make it indestructible feels cool, also feels hard. Exiling three creatures is actually kind of a sizable cost sometimes. Not a good blocker until you give it the indestructible counter. And it just, yeah, I don't know. Sometimes I've noticed that, like, you know, if I just had another Zulaport Cutthroat in play, I'd already be doubling stuff. And that one was cheaper and only cost me a quarter. So this is a card that I've gone back and forth on a lot. I don't know if you guys have any experience with it, but Drivnod has not performed for me the way that I initially thought that it would.
So I think this might be part of the same discussion as when we talked earlier about doubling and tripling tokens. Mm-hmm. But one thing we didn't mention then, and I think is kind of relevant there as well as here, your decks only have so many slots for this kind of effect. If you are playing a token deck, you can only really devote so many slots to doubling or tripling those tokens. If you're playing a deck that cares about death triggers, there's only so many slots you can devote to doubling up those triggers, or you might find yourself in a position where you have trigger doublers and nothing generating those actual death triggers. Mm-hmm. or ways to forcibly, because you're also like probably running sack outlets, and like there's a lot of moving pieces in those kind of decks, and you can very easily find yourself in a position where you have too many payoffs and nothing to actually pay off. I think that's something we've seen with like the red damage doublers. We've gotten to the point where there's so many of them. You know, once upon a time, you could jam the Fire Emancipation and Gratuitous Violence and the Insult and Injury or whatever you wanted in a single deck.
Right.
There's probably too many today to do that without finding yourself in a position where you have nothing to generate damage in the first place to double or triple it.
Yeah.
So I wonder if we aren't getting a little bit of that here, where like you run the risk if you've put too many of these things in your deck, you can find yourself in a position where you don't have any triggers to cause in the first place.
Yeah, and also too, like, to me at least, spending 5 mana on a creature that only has 3 toughness, the Drivnod's kind of a terrible blocker until you pay the mana on the ability to put the indestructible counter on there too, which that you don't want to be have to do that to make your blockers relevant. And so to me, that I see why people would want to play this, but also the Tesa Karlov direct comparison there. There's a lot that's going on there. You see why you would want to play it, but also there's a lot that it's just taking away from its ability to be played in as much as you want to put it in there.
Yeah, yeah. Tesa being at the helm of her own deck and giving you access to white as the commander, I think is very, very relevant here. And this as a backup in a Tesa deck also totally makes a whole ton of sense to me. Having a backup is cool. Mm-hmm. But it is actually the kind of thing that requires a lot more attention than at first I thought it was. I thought that I could kind of just like put this into a deck and it would just be like, by nature of what the deck is doing, it's just going to amplify everything the deck is doing. And that isn't necessarily actually the case. You do have to get other setup pieces in play that this will then amplify, and that's a smaller percentage of the deck than at first it seems. And I guess ultimately this kind of feels like it has the classic, is this good in Aristocrats problem, where it's just like, yeah, everything's good in Aristocrats though. Like, Aristocrats is a really crowded field. It's kind of like that. Is this good in a Moldrotha deck? Yeah, it's hard to find cards that are bad in a Moldrotha deck, but you do have to make some cuts because of how good everything is. And this one, I don't know, if you're playing like a Linda as well, like where it's your commander has multiple death triggers, that could also be the kind of thing that I think this really amplifies. Those are cool moments. But I tried putting this into a whole lot of decks because I play Aristocrat style, Necromancy style strategies a lot. And I kept on cutting Drivnod, and I was really sad. I'm still trying to make this one work. I do not think it's a bad card, and the price is not nearly as egregious as some of the other ones that I've picked in this episode.
Yeah.
So I don't regret having this one, and if you out there are also trying this one, power to you. But I have found this one to occupy a much more awkward spot in my mana curve and in my decks than I expected it to when I first saw it. And that's just a thing that I wanted to put out there, is like, I think I overrated this card.
Yeah, well, and it's in over 42,000 decks too. So there's a lot of people that are trying to put this in there and make it work. And I don't know, to me, I also agree with your arguments against it, Joey. So I'm with you on this.
And one final thing against it too, the indestructible counter that you can put on it requires you to do something that oftentimes actively hurts your strategy, which is exile three creatures from your graveyard. So like to actually make it a really good blocker, like you said, Matt, that is kind of fighting against what the deck is oftentimes trying to do as well. And that's, I mean, not a reason not to run it, but it's also one more thing that makes it less attractive than I think people realize.
That is a bigger cost than a lot of the other Dominus kind of stuff, like Mondrak, which can just like, oh, sacrifice stuff. I probably already wanted to do that. Like, that'll give me benefits.
Right.
Exiling stuff from my graveyard is a much steeper cost. You're absolutely right. Okay, That was mine, but now let's move on to one of y'all's. Dana?
My last one here is a transcendent message. Four blue and X. It has convoke and draw X cards. So generally speaking, I don't like X draw spells. Their utility is almost entirely predicated on you having a ton of mana free and nothing else to use it on. And I don't think that's a good position to hope to find yourself in a game. Now, what makes Transcendent Message a little bit better is that it has Convoke. So if like you are playing in a particular deck where you have a bunch of bodies out, being able to tap it to reduce that cost and still draw cards is offsets that and makes it look like it's going to be much better. But I've tried this card in a deck that's mono blue, so the four pips isn't a problem, that makes a bunch of creatures, my Talran Sky Summoner deck, that's very dedicated to just making drakes as a win condition. And even there, it's really, really clunky. I find I want to be attacking with those drakes, and even in situations where I was making multiples in a turn that I then couldn't attack with, so they were available to draw cards off Transcendent Message, I still found like very rarely did I have enough to offset the cost enough to make this better than just drawing two cards off Winged Words or just drawing two cards off Chart of Course. Okay, the investment of resources to make this not feel bad, even in kind of a perfect deck, very rarely felt good. And if you're not playing a perfect deck, which I don't think the 26,000 people that are running this are doing, I think it's an overrated card.
Matt, I think you'd had experience with this one in your, was it your Ovika deck?
So I didn't put it in my Ovika deck. I remember a few episodes ago, I had mentioned the color balance of everything where you're trying to cast a lot of cheap red spells.
Right.
And then there's also right next to it, it's Transcendent Message, especially because you're playing cards that like you can sacrifice goblins to add red mana, but that doesn't help you cast Transcendent Message. So it's a card I think people should be mindful of because triple blue is quadruple blue. That's even more harder to do than triple blue.
Yeah.
Quadruple blue X it's a hard thing to pull off. And so I get why, Dana, you're saying this is a card to if you're going to put in decks, be mindful of it because absolutely the mana cost is going to be very, very hard to pull off. But I actively do not want to put this into my Ovika deck because quadruple blue in a deck that very heavily skews into red spells and a little bit of blue, I see this being kind of hard to pull off.
Yeah, even if you do have enough blue creatures to pay that convoke cost, it still has the problem of like, okay, you have a big board and here's a card that's going to get you more value.
Yeah.
And it is a lot if you can pull those moves off, but it does make you wish that like, man, when I've got a big board, you know what I want? I want something like reverse the polarity that's going to make them unblockable and then I can just snag someone that way. Like
right.
Those are the kinds of things. Like if you've got a winning position, is this card helping you definitely win the game or is it amplifying extra value? And I think that's kind of a pitfall that this one happens to fall into.
If you are in a position to make this a good card, you're also in a position to just win the game versus drawing a bunch more cards.
Probably, yeah. Yeah, so cosign with you on that one. And I'm glad that we've moved away from talking about black cards. Yay. Matt, how about your last one?
Well, let's get away from dogging on black cards. Let's go back to dogging on white cards instead. So Elish Norn, the flip Elish Norn that has one side as a saga and then the front side is an actual creature. This one I see in so many decks and I'm not terribly impressed with it. So Elish Norn, it's two white for a 3/5 vigilance, Phyrexian Praetor. If a source an opponent controls deals damage to you or a permanent you control, that source's controller loses two life unless they pay one mana. They can pay two and a white to sacrifice three other creatures, exile Elish Norn, return it to the battlefield as a saga that has three separate chapters. It's kind of slow. But anyways, the front side just, to me, it's so preventable.
Yeah.
One mana is not that huge of a deal, but it's being played in over 19,000 decks. I understand the appeal of wanting to ping your opponents back and discourage them from dealing damage to you, but a lot of times in Commander, if people are dealing damage, they're dealing lethal damage, so this triggered ability doesn't even come into play. So again, combine that with the did you pay the one type of argument, except people are going to be more willing to pay to stay alive than they are to give you a card versus like Rhystic Study, the very obvious comparison there. But also the backside, the saga, in addition to needing to sacrifice creatures, which sometimes can be a benefit or easy to pull off, but you have to downsize your board. then in a couple turns to give them all double strike. And that, to me, it's working against itself. Mm. There's a lot of things that are either they're negligible, it's too slow, or it's fighting against itself when trying to be a more effective card. I don't see why people are so high on this. In my mind, and it hurts me to say this, but like, it's probably the weakest of all the Praetor cards we've ever gotten. I don't think this specific version of Elesh Norn is great, because the other versions of Elesh Norn have been bonkers powerful.
Oh, yeah. Like the original Elesh Norn Grand Cenobite or Elesh Norn Mother of Machines, doubling your blink stuff. Like those cards, this is not. And it's showing up in 2% of decks that are eligible to play it is actually a higher inclusion rate than I expected as well. This is one that I'm like, huh. Yeah. I don't know that I'd play this anywhere. I think that there's probably like, if there people are playing like a strong Phyrexian theme deck, then this one's got a home there. But it doesn't strike me as a card that I'm like, oh, you know what? I can't wait to play.
Yeah.
That's my feeling the same way. Like I read this card and I'm like, oh, I know what deck wants to run this, but there's not 19,000 of those decks. I don't think out there that have a home that makes sense for this. And I don't. It's one of those cards. I think this is true of all the cards that we're talking about here, and that's probably why they are still in decks. None of them are ever bad,
right?
Yeah.
Many times they're quite good, but are they better than something else you could be running in that slot? I think very rarely is that answer yes. There's almost always something that's going to be doing the thing that you're doing better and more consistently in the deck where these want to run.
Well, and here's something interesting. I am actually surprised. Like, first of all, none of us named a green card in our discussions here for overrated stuff. And I'm actually surprised because I anticipated that maybe Matt would have talked about a card that when we did a year in review for 2023, he labeled the card Delighted Halfling, the green mana dork, as an overrated card from the past year. It's showing up in 93,000 decks. It's showing up in 11% of decks that are available to play it. And it costs like $12. For this mana dork that can give you a mana of any color only for a legendary spell, and that spell can't be countered, or it can just tap for a colorless. Matt, is there a specific reason that you didn't want to touch on this one, or where's your head at with Delighted Halfling nowadays?
I probably still the same. I think all my arguments still hold up, and I know a lot of listeners and the comments especially pushed back on my stance on Delighted Halfling. Mm. I think a lot of the arguments that apply to those are like to my concerns about Delighted Halfling, they're towards the top end of the power spectrum. If you're playing in that CEDH circle, then yeah, you absolutely want that uncounterable because so much of people's decks sometimes can depend on the commander being in play. And if that's the argument, then yeah, I get that. But my arguments specifically were for the typical player in the casual side of the spectrum, that doesn't matter more often than not. And so it's not that mana dorks aren't powerful, because they certainly are. I don't think that this one specifically is $12 powerful. I think the money, the hype around it, I don't think it lines up with how powerful and how we should be valuing a mana dork for our format.
Yeah, that was the thing that I also kind of wanted to bring home here as well. A lot of the cards that I chose, to me, it felt like a discrepancy between what the card performs as and its current price point.
Exactly.
Feels to me like a real situation of like where overrated actually is kind of useful, because you don't need to go out and spend $12 for this thing. If you're playing an Avacyn Spellgrim, if you're playing a Land of War Elves, like 25-cent mana dorks are going to do a pretty similar enough job that you don't need to spend this much money on a card like this. You know, I don't feel compelled to go and drop $21 on that O'Hare Talk to double up or to triple up my tokens, because I don't think that it would do $21 worth of power for my decks and have that much of an impact. And so that's kind of like a final lesson for me, is like paying attention to the price and really evaluating what is worth it to you, because a lot of cards that are a quarter can accomplish a lot of the same effects that you're looking for that some of these card slots would, you know, presuppose. And that's just a final lesson that I thought would be important to take away. I think Delighted Halfling's a good example of that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, to continue down that kind of road, Cavern of Souls.
Sure,
is a card I'm running in multiple decks, because I've had Cavern of Souls, or I've gotten them, you know, in a draft environment or something, or whatever. The amount of times that's been relevant over just the land that makes mana, I could count on one hand in a decade. And that's probably exaggerating. I don't even know if it's been that many times where that's been relevant, where it's saved me from doing a particular thing. Not saying it can't happen, but like, is it worth the amount of money you pay for those two games? You know, every 5 or 6 years? I don't know if it is.
Uh-oh, Dana. You've opened the door to beyond just cards from this past year.
Right, yeah, right, yeah.
All right, let's gear up. Whole new episode. All right, brainstorm.
Most overrated cards from Innistrad. Go. Yeah.
Watch out. Farewell. Overrated. Right. We can name so many if we open that door. And maybe we will for a few future episodes, but this was an interesting way to look at the past year. Generally speaking, we loved a whole lot of cards from last year. So these were just some standouts that were like, were they as effective for us as we thought? I'm sure, very sure, that plenty of listeners have had very opposite experiences than we have with a whole lot of these cards. We would love to hear your perspectives on these and which cards you think are overrated. This really becomes one of those one person's trash is another person's treasure kind of discussions,
sure.
I think. So yeah, tell us your opinions. We'd really, we'd love to hear them. But if you're going to do that, you might as well like and subscribe while you're there. But with that, I think we're going to call this episode to a close. So fellas, if our listeners want to get in touch with us, where can they find you online? Matt?
So you can find me on pretty much any social media platform out there. That's always the same handle, though, at Mathemus55. And don't forget, we are proud members of Team Ultimate Guard. So if you want some of the best accessories for your magic cards, your deck boxes, your sleeves, any of that, head to Ultimate Guard for all of your deck building accessory needs.
And Dana?
You can find me on the interwebs at Dana Roach. I'm writing articles for EDH Rec and Commander's Herald. And you can find all of us together at MagicCon Chicago, as well as at patreon.com/EDHRecCast.
And I'm Joey Schultz. You can find me at Joseph M. Schultz online. Most likely I'm being a fool on Instagram. And you can find the cast at EDHRecCast everywhere online. Plus, if you've got a question for us, you can contact us at EDHRecCast@gmail.com. Our thanks go out once again to Chase for their fantastic work in the post-production of the show. You can find them online at ManaCurves. Listeners, we'll be back at you next week with more data and insights. But until then, remember, EDH Rec your deck before you wreck your deck.